We're going to be in Joshua this morning. Most of y'all probably know what woman I'm going to be talking about this morning. Most of y'all probably know her name, her profession, where she resided, and quite a bit about her. So this should be easy. Shouldn't have to teach you anything new today. First thing we're going to be talking about is Rahab. If you'll go to the second chapter, the book of Joshua, I am going to read the majority of the text that we are going to be in. We are going to pray, and hopefully I will help you view Jericho as you have not yet viewed it. Starting in verse 1 of chapter 2. Now Joshua the son of Nun sent out two men from some grove I can't pronounce to spy secretly, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." So they went and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country." So the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the country." Verse 4. Then the women took the two men and hid them. So she said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And it happened as the gate was being shut, when it was dark, that the men went out. Where the men went, I do not know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them." Verse 6. But she had brought them up to the roof and hid them with the stalks of flax, I think that's how you pronounce that, which she had laid in order on the roof. Then the men pursued them by the road to the Jordan, to the fords, and as soon as those who had pursued them had gone out, they shut the gate. Verse 8. Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, whose names I can't read, whom you utterly destroyed." Verse 11. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you, for the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you also will show kindness to my father's house, and give me a true token, and spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death. So the men answered her, "Our lives for yours, if none of you will tell this business of ours, and it shall be, when the Lord has given us the land, that we will deal kindly and truly with you." We'll go ahead and stop there. So we're going to get an introduction to the person of Rahab. We already read the text. We all know this story. I probably didn't need to read the text. What do we know about Rahab? Outside of what we've just read, she's mentioned a couple times in the New Testament, two of which are very popular. Hebrews 11:31 and James 2:25. She's commended for her actions. Hebrews 11:31 says that by faith she did not perish along with the disobedient of Jericho, because she welcomed the spies with peace. James 2:25 says that she was justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way. Neither of those mention her lying. Those of y'all who are in the "is lying godly" discussion know that she is a liar. And as my sister Hannah says, liars go to hell. Thankfully for me, liars go to heaven too. The other mentioning of her in the New Testament is well known in Matthew. She's in Jesus' lineage. At least we think she's in Jesus' lineage. I'm not going to get into the details of that. But those of y'all who have spent any time with me know that I have questions concerning her name in Matthew. You can come talk to me afterwards if you want. But I wanted to jump back to Hebrews, for it clearly describes why she was preserved, why she was not a part of the destruction. Outside of her and her family, the entire city-state of Jericho is destroyed. If you're in Hebrews, chapter 11, the hall of faith, the chapter of faith, the description of faith, whatever you want to call this chapter, Starting in the 30th verse, it says, "By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days." Verse 31, "By faith the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace." I'm really hoping that some of y'all have a translation, a different translation than mine. Verse 31 should read that she did not perish with those who were disobedient. They're the same thing. Hopefully you don't want to, you know, jump the gun on the message, but I want you to walk away understanding that those two things are tied directly together. You're disobedient when you don't allow yourself to believe what God has told you to believe. He makes it very clear. He makes it very evident. You respond to it, but you don't comply. You don't comply. It's as simple as that. I wish the Bible were more complicated, because then people could write books and sell them about it. Wait, that already happens. But it is this simple. God tells you what to do and you comply. Why don't we do it? Hopefully we'll get into that. But I wanted to draw very clearly, because we're going to kind of avoid Rahab and the fact that she is saved in Jericho, because we already know why she was saved. She was saved because she was obedient. We're going to take a look at what that obedience actually entailed. So if you'll go back with me to Joshua, I'm going to give you some of the context of the situation. For the Hebrews, they have just crossed over, well, they're in the process of crossing over the Jordan River. They've just spent 40 years in the desert. I don't know if that equates to like 10 years with teenagers, but they were not very happy, and everyone over the age of 20 died. So take that as you will. It's a very young generation of Hebrews. A few of them may remember the Red Sea. Joshua probably did. Caleb probably did. But there were quite a few of them that did not remember the Red Sea. Joshua has just sent over 2 spies. I think that's because only Joshua and Caleb came back the first time with good reports, so he only sent 2 this time. And the Israelites have just celebrated the Passover after having been circumcised. For the Canaanite people, where are they from? Where's Rahab? What's Rahab's state of mind as she's going into this? The Israelites have just made a conquest of everyone on their path to the Holy Land, the Promised Land. They have killed everybody in their way. Why? Because God told them to, and because God gave them the ability to. But needless to say, these people, all they know is that these guys are not losing. They're not even close to it. The words used to describe are conquered, destroyed, slaughtered. These weren't close fights. The Israelites were rolling through opposing nations on their way to the Holy Land. We see the emphasis on this in Rahab's statement in chapter 2, it's verse 11. "And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you, for the Lord your God." They're not ignorant of why the Israelites are winning. They know exactly why they're winning. They know exactly what he's capable of doing. And they are really, really scared, for lack of better terms. Their hearts had melted. That's prophetic. God had said that he would give the people a faint heart, that it would melt when they heard the things that he was going to do for the Israelites. It's all working out as God planned. And they don't like that. For us, what's the context for us? What's Jericho for us? Do you know that Jericho is the number one source of historical debunking of the Old Testament? Because its date doesn't line up with what we predict. Scholars, archaeologists think that the Old Testament is completely rubbish because of that. I find it kind of funny. The archaeologist that they claim really determined the year within a 95% certainty, she had this to say about the destruction of Jericho, because it's been destroyed quite a few times. "The destruction was complete. Walls and floors were blackened or reddened by fire. Every room was filled with fallen brick, timbers, and household utensils. In most rooms, the fallen debris was heavily burnt." What's funny is in her report, the north side of the wall was still standing. And they found houses in the north side of that wall that for some reason, despite all the other areas around Jericho, had been fallen and burnt. There was one portion that wasn't. So because the dates are wrong, we're not going to believe it. But because the description of what happened is entirely accurate, we're still not going to believe it. Carbon dating in this period is a mess. I'm not even going to get into it. Needless to say, when they do carbon dating on the walls of Jericho, they get two dates. I'm not a scientist, but that's not how it's supposed to work. You're supposed to give them a sample, and you're supposed to get a time period, plus or minus 7 days, or 7 years. They got two complete different sets and ranges of dates. For some reason, don't know, but carbon dating in that time period is completely debunked. John might know more. He seems to know a little bit of everything. Apparently John doesn't know. Don't ask him. But needless to say, I want you to know, and I don't know if you've ever encountered this, I have a couple of times, Jericho is not a laughing point. Don't let people come up to you and say, oh, Jericho didn't fall when you said it did. Ha ha ha, everything must be true. Your Bible actually kind of, the little inscriptions where the commentary is, they're guessing on those dates. They kind of know, but they're not entirely sure. So I want to encourage you, this is a true story. And the details line up, even if our estimated dates do not. That's the context of the story for us as we move forward. So let's get into the actual story itself. We're going to get into the interaction. We're going to skip over a lot of the description of what Rahab does in lying, because I want to read this to you in more of a chronological order. So we're going to start in verse 8. If you're with me in verse 8, we've already read over the lying. It says, now before they lay down, that means this happened before the previous text we just read, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that Yahweh, the Lord, your Lord should be in capital letters, has given you the land. And then she prophetically tells them, our inhabitants have terror, we're faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water, miracle number one, what you did to the king of the Amorites, miracle number two. She knows a whole lot. It's safe to say that just as much as she knows, everyone in Jericho knows. She has a house by the wall. This is probably the outer wall. From what I studied and researched, Jericho was not a two-walled city. Apparently those had not quite been invented yet. Great for commerce, so people were coming in and going out. She probably heard a whole lot. But she knew enough to lie about not knowing where they were from. It's probably because everyone in the city knew who was coming and what they did. And I want to make this point, drill this point in, because knowledge is not hard to come by. You can go to school, you can pay, you don't even have to pay, you can just sit in the class actually. Applying it is not so easy to come by. Being able to defend it afterwards is sometimes even harder to come by. And really, truly being convinced that it's always going to work out 100% of the time is even harder to come by. But knowledge itself is very easy to come by. Rahab has a lot of knowledge. The Red Sea happened over 40 years before this occurred. How many of y'all can tell me 10 facts from something that happened 40 years ago in a specific year, in a specific week? Now this one's a little monumental. I mean, it's the Red Sea crossing, all of Pharaoh's army died. It's kind of world news. But this is not what they heard last week. This has been passing down for 40 years. The same story has been in circulation. The entire time that they're in the wilderness, they are attacked, they destroy people. All these things did not just happen last week. These are stories they've accumulated over years. They're very aware. They're very knowledgeable of what God is doing. She even knows his name. Not your God. Not a God. Not the God of Moses. She uses the word Yahweh, Jehovah. Verse 8, she uses it. I know that the Lord has given you the land. She says it again in 11. For the Lord, your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. She uses it in verse 12. Swear to me by the Lord. They even know His name. This is a special name. This has not always been His name. He had not always had this revealed to the Israelites. This is a special name given to Moses and then given to the Israelites. It's a declaration of, I am who I am. I am the God of Abraham. I am the God of Isaac. I am the God of Jacob. This is the verse that precedes that you shall have no other gods before me. Or outside of me is another good way to translate that. This word has a lot of connotation. They even know that. She knows the theological importance to this word. Perhaps others didn't, perhaps others did. But it's very clear and it's very evident in their interaction. She has a whole lot to say. They don't say very much other than thank you for saving us. She's one very learned individual. Her request for safety is even more unique. See, not only does she know what God has done, she knows what God can do. She can project. If A equals B, A still equals B. I mean, she's really on top of it. If God could save you when destruction was coming, He can probably save me when destruction is coming. I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, Yahweh, this is still in verse 12, since I have shown you kindness, that you will show kindness to my father's house. This may seem like it's selfish and like she's asking the wrong person because she just asked the men to save her instead of asking God directly. But I want to draw your thought to, she professes who God is and she knows who His servants are and who are going to do His work. I profess God, I know who's going to carry out His plan. I'm going to tell those who are carrying out His plan, hey look, we're on the same team here. Go with me. Let's jump to the end of this story. Joshua chapter 6. Joshua chapter 5. Really more 6. Verse 21. We're going to ignore Joshua's commands to walk around the city 7 times. Whole trumpet blowing, walls come down. Verse 21. And they utterly destroyed, they as in the Israelites, all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep and donkey with the edge of the sword. You know, we like to think that Jericho was won when the wall fell. It was won when the Israelites ran through and killed everybody and then burned the place to the ground. Rahab knows how warfare goes about. She knows that God is going to aid the Israelites. She knows that the Israelites are going to beat Jericho. She knows that the Israelites are going to come in and kill everyone in Jericho. That's standard warfare. There's no point in leaving an enemy behind if in 40 years he's just going to raise up another generation and then they're going to come and kill you again. In fact, that's exactly what the Israelites did 40 years ago. They tried to get into the Promised Land. They were defeated after disobeying God. They sat in the wilderness for 40 years and then they came back and they killed everyone in the Promised Land. So Rahab, her plight, her understanding, her projection of what God can do, they're all spot on. Can't come down on her at all, except for the lying thing. We'll get there. She's a wonderful example to live by, except for the lying thing again. Wonderful, oh, and the harlotry. She's one. She's one person in an entire city. She is one person with the same amount of knowledge as everyone else. She's one person with the same opportunity as everyone else. She's it. Now her family is going to be saved from destruction. We'll get there hopefully before 12 o'clock. But she's one person. What about all the other ones? They do the same thing. They knew the same miracles. They'd seen all the same examples. that she had seen. And I couldn't help, at that point, when I was reading it, I couldn't help but just get a stream of Bible verses from all over where we are so evidently just, God is placed in our face. He just puts Himself there. He's like, look, you can't look anywhere else. Here I am. And you just close your eyes, stick your head in the ground, plug your ears. And I'm not just talking to non-saved people. I'm talking to saved people too. If you think God's done talking to you after you're saved, then you're probably one in the group of people I was just talking about. And I couldn't help but realize that this is not an encouraging text. There is a whole city of people, the majority of people just like you and me, who go down with the destruction of Jericho because despite everything they know, they're unwilling to be obedient. Rahab was, and it put her in the hall of faith. So let's go back to what Rahab did do wrong. We're just going to kind of skip through here because I feel the need to fix the problems and errors I had during that discussion time. Joshua 2:2. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country. News travels very fast in Jericho. So the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, bring out the men, for they have come to search out all the country. Then the woman took the two men and hid them. So she said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. I think we all know that's a lie. Number one. And it happened as the gate was being shut, when it was dark, that the men went out. Lie number two. Where the men went, I do not know. Lie number three. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them. I'm going to give her the benefit of the doubt on that one. She was not supposed to lie. I'm going to leave this up to the reader because I think that people should study. There is at least two Old Testament and one New Testament verses that say that God does not lie. He's not capable of lying. And I don't know about you, but if God can't do it, it's probably not something I want to do. Just going to put that out there. You're welcome to take your own view on what sin is. I tend to think that we were made to model God, and so if He doesn't do something, I'm not supposed to do something. If He says that He's incapable of doing it because it is bad, it probably means that I should be incapable of doing it because it was bad. But, despite all of that, Rahab did lie. Rahab did profess a saving belief in Jehovah. And as we'll see, she is accepted as an Israelite. So we can safely say that God forgave her of that sin. I want to go to the promise. We've read all this. We know what she asked for. We know what she knew. We know where she was coming from. She wanted it bad enough to lie. So let's see what she got in return. Verse 15. Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall. She dwelt on the wall. Not a very safe place to be when people are going to come attack. And she said to them, go to the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you. Hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. That's kind of why I'm not giving her, counting the whole you might track them down thing as a lie. They are going to be out around the same time. Afterwards, you may go your way. Verse 17, so the men said to her, we will be blameless of this oath, this promise of yours, which you have made us swear. Unless when we come into the land, you bind this line of scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down. And unless you bring your father, your mother, your brothers, and all your father's household to your home. So it shall be that whoever goes outside of the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we will be guiltless. And whoever is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head if a hand is laid on him. And if you tell this business of ours, then we will be free from your oath, which you have made us swear. Then she said, according to your words, so be it. And she sent them away, and they departed, and she bound the scarlet cord in the window. Verse 22. They departed and went to the mountains and stayed there 3 days until the pursuers returned. The pursuers sought them all along the way, but did not find them. So the two men returned, descended from the mountain, and crossed over. And they came to Joshua the son of Nun and told them all that had befallen them. And they said to Joshua, "Truly the Lord has delivered all the land into our hands. For indeed all the inhabitants of the country are faint-hearted because of us." Rahab got exactly what she asked for. Promise from the spies that when they came back, when they were going to destroy Jericho, that they would not harm her. We all knew that. Not anything groundbreaking. But I really clung on to, why did they make her do anything? She already professed Jehovah. Why are they making her do anything? And to be honest with you, there are quite a few reasons why they may have made her do this. These two spies are not aware of God's plan. In fact, Joshua at this point isn't even aware of God's plan to bring down Jericho. And so what they may have been thinking is that this cord is going to let us know from the outside, hey, we don't want to tear down this portion of the wall. We don't want to aggressively attack this portion of the wall. It may have been that they anticipated on climbing up at night as a way of sneaking into Jericho and taking it down from the inside. I always get, you know, the whole Trojan horse imagery at that point. But we don't know. But what I do know is this. I know she has faith because of her works. If that didn't bring to mind James 2:17, I can try again by actually reading James 2:17, which says, faith without works is dead. See, disobedience is not allowing yourself to believe what God has told you and acting contrary to it. Faith, believing God, is going to lead you to acting exactly how you should, how He wants you to. You can say whatever you want to say. You can know whatever you want to know. You can truly believe it. You can know that God can affect the future for you. But if you don't act in correlation with it, it's useless. And for her, it would have been useless. She would not have been saved if that scarlet cord had not been put out. Do I think that's fair? I'll leave that to you. She also garners protection for her family in this promise. Her mother, her father, her brothers, and all of his father's household, or all of her father's household, that come into the home. They're not safe out there. They got to come in. They don't just get in free. They got to come. They've got to accept and be covered by the promise in which you've established with us. I don't know about you, but I got a serious Passover flashback when I read this. When God tells them to slaughter a lamb, bring everyone into the house, paint the blood on the doorposts. Everyone that's in the house with the blood will be saved from the destroyer that's going to come through. And I thought, well, man, is that really fair? You know, the family gets to come in. But then they say, if you tell this business of ours, we're going to be free from this. So you can save your family, your best friend. She wasn't a part of that deal. You can't tell her. That baker you really like? Nah. Basically, Dennis's ribs would not have gotten him into Rahab's house. That's what I'm saying. And I thought, man, that's not fair. Don't they all deserve the exact same chance? And then I stopped myself and I realized they all already had it. They were residing in Jericho. They had decided that Jericho was the safest place for them in opposition to God. They knew it opposed God, but it was the safest place for them. My dad always laughs because I always find myself in Romans 1. But if you'll turn to Romans 1 with me, I can't for sure say that this absolutely describes the people in Jericho to a T. But I believe it does. And instead of feeling like this was not fair that they didn't get an opportunity, I reminded myself of what Scripture says about people who are disobedient to God. Romans 1, verse 18. Actually, let's go to verse 17 so we can remember what Rahab is, and then we'll get into what everyone else is. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. That's Rahab. Verse 18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and all unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. They know the truth. They suppress it. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them. For God has shown it to them, for since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. I stopped feeling guilty at that point, but I kept going, because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, They knew God. They knew what He had done. They knew that He was coming against them, but they didn't feel like glorifying Him, nor were they thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God. They took what they knew about God and they made it into an image like corruptible man, birds, four-footed animals, and creeping things. Therefore, God also gave them up to their uncleanliness. Verse 25, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forevermore. You now kind of understand why I love Rahab's statement, you're the God of heaven above and earth beneath it. You created it. I understand who's in control here. Everyone else in Jericho did not. They were not willing to submit to that. Verse 26, for this reason God gave them up to vile passions. Verse 27, likewise also the men. Verse 28, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, it bugged them to remember God. Does it bug you to wake up in the morning and remember you need to read your Bible? Does it bother you that God actually exists? That He actually has a say in what you do? God gave them over to a debased mind to do things which are not fitting. I always like this list, so I'm just going to read it for the fun of it. Being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness, they are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things. That's so impressive. Disobedient to parents, undiscerning, disobedient to parents, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. That's why I don't think Rahab was too upset with leaving the debased, defiled, and immoral people in Jericho to the destruction they had chosen. She had submitted. She had declared who God was. She had taken in the truth. She had kept it for herself. She had acknowledged it. And the truth of God that was prevalent to everyone else in Jericho was rejected. Are you catching a theme? I complained to my Sunday school class. I complained to the band who are in my Sunday school class. I complained to my wife, who's also in my Sunday school class. I never felt uplifted by this. All I could come away with was, God gave it all to us already. And for me, that's enough. For me, that's where I garner my righteousness. From me, that's where you get your joy. From me, that's where you get your peace. For me, that's where we get our thanksgiving in trials. All these things that we cling to that make life manageable, they reject. And man, that just puts me in the dumps. Start feeling like Paul when he says that he would rather himself be accursed from God so that his brethren could receive righteousness. Can't help but feel like, man, that's a good trade. I love football. Love trades. One person for like 5 million, that's a good trade. But that's not how it goes. They got to make the choice on their own. So I thought, you know, seeing the promise, seeing who gets excluded from the promise, seeing tons of examples of people getting excluded from safety, what happens afterwards? Tell me it gets better afterwards. You know, I'm going to go to the end. I'm going to go to where Rahab is saved. Things are going to be better. Turn with me to chapter 6. Starting in verse 22, we have the result of this whole thing. This is the real, real end. After this, they go into Ai. They get beat up. They kill Achan. They go back to Ai. They kill Ai. And then they kill everybody else. Verse 22. But Joshua had said to the two men who had spied out the country, go into the harlot's house and from there bring out the woman and all that she has as you swore to her. And the young men who had been spies brought out Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, and all that they had. End of verse 23. So they brought out all her relatives and left them outside the camp of Israel. Verse 24. But they burned the city and all that was in it with fire, Only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. And Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all that she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day, because she hid the messengers whom Jesus sent to spy out Jericho. That's a good ending for her. That's pretty good. Get taken out, dwells in Israel to this day. And I couldn't get over the fact that all her family and her relatives aren't mentioned in that at all. We read in 23, so they brought out all her relatives and they left them outside the camp of Israel. And Jewish history says I wouldn't say history, because it's more like teaching. So that's where they stayed. They went their own way. They were preserved by God for a moment, and then they said, hey, you followers of God, we're going the other way. Rahab is said to have married Joshua. Again, just rabbi teaching. But she very clearly became a proselyte. She became an Israelite. She accepted God. She submitted to Jehovah. She submitted to the law. She submitted to the whole package. And she left her family outside the camp. You got to follow him the whole way. You got to follow what he says the whole way. You can't follow him through the fall of Jericho, through the burning, through the fires, through all the slaughtering, through the plundering, the pillaging, and then just stay outside. They did, but I wouldn't suggest it. Let me put it politely. And I started thinking, how close do you have to follow? And yet again, couldn't focus in this passage. I got led to the Red Sea. God goes through, parts everything. Israelites go through. Pharaoh's army wasn't following close enough. I don't know how many of them it was, but it was enough. It was enough to morally crush Pharaoh and Egypt. They weren't following close enough. No, they were following for wrong reasons. They weren't following close enough. Jesus himself, when he's teaching in the Gospels, has this habit of saying things that people really just don't like. And they stop following him. Now, how close were they following him? I mean, we've passed the proximity following and we've moved more to the relationship following. But I kept getting drawn back to the imagery of Rahab's family. Israel's a big, big people. Very many miles wide. They were all the way outside. Just enough. I started thinking about Christ healing the lepers. 10 of them, in fact. Only one of them comes back. 10%, that's a lot better than Rahab's. And he's a Samaritan. Of all people. I started thinking about the adulterous woman. Whether or not that's actually in the Bible defeats the point. But the woman coming, bringing her sin, all the people that come to stone her, only one walks away with her sins forgiven. That's still not a very good percentage. They're all right there. Just far enough. Just far enough. And I was reminded of a warning in Titus. You can go there with me if you want. I tend to think that this is a good thing for people to read. Titus has very few chapters. We're in the first of them. This is one of the pastoral epistles from Paul. Follows right after 1 and 2 Timothy. Paul's telling him kind of the lay of the land. This is how you're going to have to work in your church. You got some things that are not working out so well. He starts out in verse 10, "For there are many insubordinate, both idle talkers, deceivers, especially those of the circumcision." It's a reference to the Jews. Don't know how many of y'all caught that the both idle talkers and deceivers were in that list in Romans chapter 1. Go to verse 13. He makes the testimony of what they're teaching. He says, "This testimony is true, therefore rebuke them sharply that they may be sound in the faith, not giving heed the Jewish fables and commandments of men who turn from the truth." You catching the theme here? It's evident. It's there. You know it's there. "To the pure, all things are pure, but to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is impure, or nothing is pure, but even their mind and conscience are defiled. They profess to know God, but in works they deny Him, being abominable disobedient and disqualified for every good work. I actually like the other translations of that better. It says, being unbelieving and worthless for any good work. I don't know about you, I got bad days. There are days where I'm worthless for any good work. Thankfully, my employer does not know that. But this is a little bit different. This is God's good work. This is the same God that could use Pharaoh. It's the same God that could use Joseph's brothers. It's the same God that used Judas. They deny him. These are people that profess God. They deny him. They may even be teachers in this situation. But in works, they deny him. Being disbelievers, they don't allow themselves to be convinced of the truth that God makes evident in their lives, and worthless for every good work. That's all I got. I didn't get anything better. I just faced it all week. I was like, dude, this is horrible. And then I realized I didn't need to be shown any better. It had already been shown to me. This is good. It's a wake-up call. A reminder of what the world is like outside and what we're supposed to leave behind. But we're called to something better. We're called to something greater. We've already been redeemed. We've already been restored. Our salvation process has left the station and it doesn't stop until you get to heaven. That's kind of a good stop. Those things I don't need to teach you. You know those. You know Christ came. You know He died. You know He was resurrected. You know it. You know He's coming again. You can project it. It says so. You don't even have to think it up yourself. You know. It's told you. Now who are you going to be? You got three choices. You got everyone in Jericho who knows all the exact same things. You got Rahab's family. You might pass the first judgment. You know those first few plagues, if you read the book of Revelation literally. God might protect you from those. Might protect you from the second, third, and fourth. But when God's judgment comes, when God's people move out, when they set up camp somewhere else, are you outside? Or are you Rahab? The one person in the whole story. That's not good odds. That's why John told them, so that you may know you have eternal life. You've got to stay in the light. Avoid the dark. You do good. Not just good morality good, but good because God told you to do it good. The song we're going to sing, and I can never remember the name because we just started singing it last week. I actually picked this hymn out 3 weeks ago because of this message. You see, we are called to do nothing more than what Jesus Christ already did. He came. He submitted Himself to God. He did everything God asked Him, the Father, for His glory, even to death on the cross. That included saving us. It wasn't just limited to saving us. All He's asking is for a repeat performance. Granted, a less exhilarating encore, but it's still glory. It's still praise. And it's so that when we enter the kingdom, that can continue. The words of the song are written from the point of Jesus. I gave my life for thee. What the heck have you given for me? That's not really how it goes. But that's what it's saying. And that's all I could get out of this. What the heck have you given up for me? You know the truth. I don't need to tell you that again. Where's the fruit? You've got to know the chances aren't good. You've got to commit yourself. You've got to stand firm. You've got to finish the race. All those verses that we love to hear, you got to do them. They don't just come as a package. You got to pursue them. You have to remind yourself of them. You have to strive for them. This is not a roller coaster. It's more like a triathlon. That's all I got.